everybody. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hi, family. My name's Lindsay. I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And I'm going to slide right into introducing our speaker tonight. I have had the honor and privilege of sponsoring this young lady for a few years now. I know sponsorship to me is such an important aspect of this program. It is a gift that when I was early, I didn't realize what a gift sponsorship is. She has helped me grow. We've helped each other grow. She had a little slip a couple of years ago, but she came back with renewed dedication and a renewed sense of her place in this world, and she has really stepped up to the plate and been of service. She's got a couple sponsees. When she told me she had first time had a sponsee, I was like, yes! You know, because I know the gift that is and how much it has helped me grow. And with that, I will give you Marnie D.
Hi, family. I'm Marnie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
my lovely sponsor gave me this the first time I told my story. This is only the second time I've told my story. I told mine at my home group, and she gave this to me. She said this was what her sponsor gave to her, so I hold it close by me so I can look at it. My sobriety date is November 3rd, 2017. I grew up in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. And right there I have to stop and say, well, my address is Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. We actually live off a little peninsula called Buckingham, which is in between Hilton Head and Bluffton, and that will be a little tiny part of my story. Life was pretty, you know, idyllic at first. I didn't realize that my dad had a problem when I was younger. But I guess my mom had told me that I didn't really know him, you know, the way that she knew him. They both came from, alcohol and mental illness run rampant in my family. Both my grandfathers died of alcoholism. One died of cirrhosis of the liver. The other one died in a drunk driving accident. And so my parents had a very difficult upbringing with a lot of physical abuse and neglect. And they definitely wanted better for my brother and I, and they did. They produced better for us, and for that I'm so grateful to them. They've been loving parents. But from the get-go growing up, I was very much a fantasy person. I lived in a fantasy world. You know, what I wanted was always grandiose. You know, I've always been a big lover of animals. What I wanted was a pony. And when, you know, it came Christmas time, I expected that pony to be tied up at our chain link fence, you know, and always set myself up for disappointment because I would have such high expectations of what I wanted and what I thought I deserved. And, skip forward to always had a little bit of a difficult relationship with my brother because I am daddy's little girl. I can do no wrong, and my brother could do no right, and he tended to take that out on me. When I was about 9 years old is when, and I talk about this because I like for people to understand how smart kids are at an early age. I knew that something was not quite right in my family. You know, my dad was always asleep, you know, snoring on the couch all the time when other parents were at work. He had a very lucrative business at the start of Hilton Head. Hilton Head was very small at that time, and he was in construction and was making a lot of money, and the pressure just really got to him, and he couldn't handle it. So my mom started going back to work, and we were sort of latchkey kids there for a while. When I was 9 years old, I remember my dad coming in, and that was the first time that I knew that my dad was an alcoholic. My mom had put little pamphlets all over the place, you know, for dad to pick up, you know, these pamphlets over here, how to know if you've got a drinking problem and stuff. She'd slide them in magazines. And I picked up one of them and looked through it. And it is the funniest thing to look at, because if the alcoholic is in the middle with their beer and just going through life, and then you just see all this chaos around them, you know, the kids and stuff. And you got one who's like the total bookworm, and the other one who's the troublemaker, and I was the bookworm, the want-to-be-perfect, you know, anything to distract from what was going on with Dad. And I didn't realize that at the time, that that was what I was doing, and that was what my brother and I were doing. But when I was 9, I had to have an appendectomy. And that night, my dad had gotten particularly drunk, and the focus was on him and what was going on with him. And I remember, being in a lot of pain. And I remember hearing him, you know, just being very sick. And that was when I realized, wow, I was like, my dad's an alcoholic. My dad has this problem. And he got sober there for a minute. But like we all do, you know, once the crisis is over, we go back to, you know, what we were doing. I was very much, and always have been, a big animal lover. That was probably my first addiction. Any animal, I would, you know, I would chase snakes down the road, and, you know, I would keep anything that would stay caught. And when I was about 12, I kind of got introduced into horseback riding. The same time that was, this is when I was talking about, Hilton Head and Bluffton were very different, being that they were in the same place. Bluffton was very rural. There was a lot of farm kids, talked very country. And then in Hilton Head, which, you know, they were just, you know, not even a mile apart, Hilton Head had a lot of upper class people. People had a lot of money. The kids had a lot of name brand clothes and stuff. And we were separated from them up until middle school. Middle school, we got pushed together. The Hilton Head Island kids came over to Bluffton because it was the only middle school. And middle school was terrible for me, because when I was in elementary school, I was a big fish in a small pond. I was very popular. You know, I was, you know, one of the most popular people, and had a good personality and thought that I was the shit. And I got to that school, and I learned really quick that I was nothing if I didn't have the right shoes, the right clothes, the right look. And I did not live on the island. I will remember this, you know, just goes back to where I was already started. I already felt uncomfortable with myself. Didn't feel like I belonged. Always felt like something was wrong with me. And the kids, one day on the school bus, we got on the school bus, and because our address was actually Hilton Head, the bus took us to our little peninsula just before Hilton Head, and we turned off into the peninsula, and the kids on the bus, on the Hilton Head bus, booed. They couldn't believe that they were having to drop us, you know, skanky Bluffton kids off. And that was when I really thought that, you know, I didn't know my place. Who was I? Who was this person? And I was so humiliated and so embarrassed by it that I never rode the bus again. It didn't matter if my mom had to come pick me up at 6 o'clock at night at school. I would not ride the bus again. That's when I got really into horses and horseback riding. That was a huge passion of mine. Was an addiction, really and truly. It was a healthy addiction, but it was an addiction. When my friends were going out partying and everything, I was doing everything I could at the barn to be able to keep riding because my family, we didn't have much money and they couldn't afford much. So, you know, I did a lot of cleaning tack, mucking stalls, cleaning people's houses, anything I could to get another horseback riding lesson. And I was just disgusted by my dad. I thought, if this is what, you know, this is a representation of a man, you know, this is what an alcoholic is, I want to be as far away from it as possible. He's useless. I was angry at him. There was a lot of angry silence in my household. You know, a lot of just unspoken anger. My mom would just be seething. You know, when my dad would be passed out and she just couldn't understand, you know, why he couldn't, you know, get help. And around that time, you know, I started with the horseback riding. I had my first drink at 13. Had maybe had a couple of sips of my mom's margarita at one time or something, but 13 was the first time that I drank. I went to my cousin's house. And I'll never forget that. We went to a party. I was 13, and the rest of them were like 16, which is it's not a big age difference, but it's a huge gap. Like, there's a lot more, you know, maturity to them. Well, I took a couple of drinks of some wine coolers and stuff, and then someone gave me a pint of vodka. And I remember taking that swig. Someone dared me to just take a swig of it. And I drank, you know, like half of it. And when it hit me, it was like, this is it. You know, this is it for me. I love this. All of a sudden, all that anxiety, all that I don't belong, all those fears were gone. I was comfortable around the boys. I thought that I looked amazing. And thank God that those boys had respect for my cousin, because I probably would have lost my virginity that night, because it was on. It was on just like that. And the next morning I woke up, didn't really have a hangover. It was Thanksgiving. My cousin was puking her guts out, and I was fine. And it scared me to death. And I thought, oh my God, it could so be an alcoholic. It really scared me. And I never picked up another drink until into 19, 20 years old. So I moved, started... riding professionally. That was, you know, my goal. That was what I wanted to do, and I finally got to do that. And the person that I worked with was, she was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and so I learned from the best. I learned a lot about mixing pills and alcohol, and, you know, that was a pretty bitchin' time for me. And we had a lot of fun together. And I thought that that was the career that I wanted. It just came around about the time that Christopher Reed had his accident. I had a horse flip over backwards on me, and it scared me. And I started to rethink, you know, my whole career. This is what I centered everything in, because I'm an alcoholic. You know, this was my addiction at that time, and I centered everything onto that. And when it came time that I realized that this is not what I wanted to do, I was really lost. I was probably about 20 years old, moving into 21. And even my 21st birthday, I think I had one drink. But then 22 hit, and a lady that I was teaching riding lessons with, she invited me to come and work at a golf club. And golf club is a wonderful place for people who like to drink, because everybody there loves to drink and drink around the clock. And so I had a lot of fun with the backdrop guys, going out and drinking with them. And then all of a sudden got the smart idea that it'd be fun to have a little drink during work. And it escalated very, very quickly. I went from, you know, just little party girl to drinking during lunch to having to have vodka first thing in the morning to keep me from shaking, because I couldn't even hold my pen to write. And, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And all that time, you know, I had completely lost my identity when the horses that didn't work out for me. I totally lost my identity and didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. And the drinking just continued to spiral out of control. And it really only took about 3 years' time before I really completely bottomed out. My mom knew. My dad had gotten sober when I was about 16. And a lot of things, I was able to forgive him for that. It took a while, but I was able to forgive him for, you know, his drinking. And we had started to build a relationship. But they started to see me take a spiraling turn. And I remember one night I had gotten desperate. I was living with someone else and was kind of basically a shut-in. I made a lot of mistakes, and being on an island, you know, people talk really easy, you know, really quickly. I'd really made an ass out of myself at a couple of very important functions at work, and so I decided, well, that's it, no more drinking, you know, outside. I'm only going to drink at home. So I became a closeted drinker, stayed inside and drank. My parents finally figured out what was going on with me and decided that, you know, it was time to intervene. And they asked me, you know, do you want to get help? And I said, yes, I do. So I went into detox for the first time at 24. I stayed in there for 3 days. When I left, they gave me a prescription for Anabuse and a prescription for something, Ativan, something like that. And where the Eckerd was, right next door, was the liquor store I used to go to. So my parents, their trusting selves, just handed me the credit card and let me go. I went straight to Eckerd, picked up the Anabuse, picked up the Ativan, and went straight to the liquor store and picked up the vodka. And I drank that night. They didn't know any wiser. The next morning, I went to my first outpatient therapy session. And when I got there, the people just kind of felt sorry for me. And I was really good at that, because us alcoholics are really good at, you know, you would drink if you had my life, you know. And, you know, my dad was an alcoholic and my grandfather was an alcoholic. And, you know, this is just this terrible life that I'm leading. And they co-signed that bullshit, you know, which is okay for, you know, for some people, you know, to, you know, coddling, it's okay to keep you coming back. But for me, I knew, you know, if there was a college degree, I'd have a BA in BS, you know, absolutely. And so I left there and thought, this is just not for me. Now I am out of detox for like a day and a half. And I decided, this is not going to work for me. I don't know what I'm going to do. So what did I do? I went and grabbed another bottle and went and drank. And I remember in my craziness and dealing with, I have mental illness. I have depression and anxiety. I had taken medication for eating disorder that I had developed over through my riding career. And, of course, drinking, you know, just sort of canceled that out. And I was so desperate that I ended up getting large quantities of vodka. And in my infinite wisdom, decided I was either going to drive off of a cliff. There used to be a turn bridge that sent you to Hilton Head. Now there's a regular bridge. There's a turn bridge with a giant ramp. And I was going to do like Thelma and Louise and like fly off the ramp and crash into the water in this grand, you know, suicide attempt. Or I was going to go to an AA meeting. So I'm thinking I'm going to drive to the AA meeting. And I was like, well, I'm completely drunk. I can't even talk. I'm going to turn the car around. Go to turn the car around, and this is where my higher power comes in for the first time that I remember. I ended up putting my car in the sand. The AA meeting was right at right there on the beach, and so I got stuck. And so from there, I had no cell phone service and decided, well, that's it. I took the keys out of the car, threw them in the back seat, and just upturned the bottle and just drank. I thought I was going to drink myself to death. I drank everything that was in the car as fast as I could. My best friend was looking for me. Someone at the AA meeting found me and called 911, and they picked me up. And when I got to the hospital, my blood alcohol level was 0.48. And the only reason why I didn't suffer consequences from that is because I was found so quickly, because people were looking for me. After that, I knew I needed some serious help. You know, something, you know, outpatient was not going to be enough for me. I was completely broken. I had no identity, did not know who I was anymore, and, you know, needed serious help. So I went through the detox program again, and my parents, I said, you know, I need to go somewhere, go away. So my parents looked for something, and there was a couple of places. They couldn't afford to send me to some, you know, some nice fancy place, you know, one of those 28-day programs. So there were two places. There was one that was like a Christian-based place that was in Virginia. I was like, no, that's not for me. No. And then there was another one in Gainesville called North House. And I had talked to the woman on the phone, and she said, sounds like you're a candidate for this. And she told me about the program. And I get in the next day and go into the program. I pull up at this place, and one, I did not know there was a Gainesville, Georgia. I thought I was going to Gainesville, Florida. And I did think it was a little bit weird that Gainesville, Florida had a rehab program. I mean, not, I shouldn't say weird, you know, being that, you know, it's a, you know, college town. They probably need a rehab program. But yeah, so I sat up, I was like, where the hell are we? And we pull up, and I'm thinking, because I have no idea, I've never been through any kind of rehab, never done anything like this, and I didn't realize what a extensive recovery program this was going to be. And we pull up to this house. I thought we were going to pull up to some sort of hospital-looking environment or something. No, it was this big, just dingy house. And I get out, and my parents are with me, and if I didn't have a look of shock on my face, my parents looked like they were going to pass out. Like they are leaving their daughter here. So I walk up to the front porch, and there's this big dude with tattoos all over him, bleach blonde hair, smoking a cigarette, stands up, turns, and goes, hey, I'm Pam. I'm going to be your roommate. And I was like, oh, hi. I thought you were, you know, somebody's boyfriend. But, so it was a little bit of a shock there. There were a lot, I lived with 18 women. My car was taken away from me. You know, it was a lot of shut-in. There was a lot of people there that were mandated. They were looking at a lot of jail time if they didn't complete the program. It was a very intensive program. We worked very hard on the fourth step. We went through the first and third step really quite quickly. Mainly what she wanted to work on was the fourth step, and it was extremely extensive. And it was all about learning your behaviors at a young age and what your character defects were and how they were constantly repeating themselves. A lot of mine was people-pleasing. Of course, harboring resentments, which is, you know, what we all do, love to harbor those resentments. Jealousy, you know, fear of not getting what I want. And at that time, I didn't even know what I wanted. So I, you know, had to walk to work, work at Burger King. I thought I was too good to work at Burger King. I found out really quickly I was not too good to work at Burger King. Every job deserves attention, and I actually ended up having fun there because it was, you know, kind of a, you know, I won't say mindless job, but when the day was done, I didn't have anything I had to take home. And I was always kind of obsessed with my work when I rode horses and stuff. It was all, you know, all inclusive, and so I was able to work on my program, and I worked at it really hard. And I definitely was someone that, you know, I probably could have done really well in the military because I took to it like a duck to water. You know, you told me what to do, I could do it. You know, I wanted to people please. I stayed straight. I learned how to cook for 18 women. And, you know, it was a great experience. It was a 9-month program, and when I got done with my 9 months, I thought, okay, it's time to go. You know, it's good. I'm all good. And when it was time to go, I had started working at a vet's office. She allowed me to start working. Marilyn, the lady who ran the place, allowed me to start working there. So, and it was next door to the Burger King, so I started working there for a while. And wasn't making very good money, but I thought, okay, my 9 months is up. I need to leave. It's time to go. And I really wasn't ready. Financially, I really couldn't afford to be out on my own. And that's where my need to be independent and not talk about what was really going on and talk about my fears got me into trouble. I didn't talk about the fact that I had gotten this apartment, but I really and truly couldn't afford it. I didn't ask for help from my parents. I thought that I could do it on my own. This is a 9-month program. It's time for me to leave. Everybody else is so excited to get out of here. I need to be ready to go. So about 3 days before I was going to move out, I relapsed. And the shame and humiliation that went along with that, was crushing. But for me, I am, you know, definitely someone who is that egomaniac with the inferiority complex. You know, as inferior as I feel, that is just as much of an ego that I have. You know, that I can do this on my own, I can handle it myself. And it sabotages me so many times in so many ways. So I sat there for a minute when, you know, I got busted, because basically I was drunk in the middle of a group therapy, and someone finally called me out and said, something's wrong with her. She's way too talkative and something's going on. So they called me out, took my keys away from me because I was getting ready to just bolt. And my parents came up. And when they came up, my dad was ready. You know, I was just beside myself, crying, humiliated. My dad said, we'll take you home. You know, no problem. He says, we'll take you home. Come on, baby, let's go. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't go home because I had let myself down, and I couldn't leave. I knew that it was the wrong thing to do, even though leaving the mess behind that I had was right because I was moving towards something. I still was able to escape that. You know, I was able to escape the wreckage from there. But this time, you know, I liked my job. I enjoyed what I did, and I really wanted to get better, and I wanted to figure out why this had happened. So I stayed another 9 months. I picked up my white chip and toughened it out, got the car taken away, and moved on forward again. So I did another 9 months, moved in with one of the girls at the moved in with one of the ladies that was at North House, and her husband moved in with us. And little did I know that he was still using heroin at the time. They both ended up relapsing together, and stuff started disappearing from the apartment. I was still going to meetings. I was still going to groups at North House, so I was, you know, doing pretty good. But I knew that I needed to get out of there before my stuff started disappearing. So I left. And, you know, another point where my higher power showed up in my life is that I needed to get an apartment. I needed to get one fast, and I needed to get one that I could afford. And it just so happened there was one in the paper that was perfect for me, and it's actually where I still live today. I've lived there for 15 years. And I'm so grateful for that. Now, I moved in by myself. I had everything that I really wanted. Now I was working at the vet's office, working at the job. I moved up from working as a kennel assistant to being a vet technician. So I was working with animals. I was getting to do what I wanted to do. And I became obsessed with my job again. Totally, that was, you know, all I thought about. And I had slowly there was not getting insurance. They would not insure me at the time. The insurance that the company had was Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they would not insure an alcoholic, someone who'd gone through treatment. I had to be 7 years clean before I could get insurance through the company, because the company is very small. So I tried continuing to get my medication and couldn't get my medication. But in the meantime, I'd been doing so good. I had about 4 years at that time. Kind of started slacking off on my meetings and started to think to myself, I was young. You know, vodka was really my problem. You know, I think beer and wine I'd be fine with. I mean, I saw my dad. You know, he was an alcoholic. He started taking his antidepressants, and he's had a beer every once in a while, and he's been okay. Maybe I can do that. I can do that. You know, I was just in a bad spot. I'm settled now. So I did. I picked up, and I don't even remember when I did, but that was my justification for it, and I did. And I kept that up for 9 years. Very deliberately and strictly. And of course, this is a progressive disease. It continued to get worse and worse, until finally I was extremely suicidal and had bottomed out. And one day I didn't call in for work. I turned off my phone. I shut myself in my apartment. And all this time that I was in this 9 years of hell, I was in my apartment by myself drinking, because everybody thought that I was clean. I was a sober person as far as everyone else knew. And I was living this lie. And all I was doing is working to drink. And, you know, getting up in the morning with those hellacious hangovers. And I finally just bottomed out. And my hospital manager and one of the girls actually came and kicked my door in. And, you know, they helped me. I, you know, had just lost all sense of myself. And so I picked myself up and went to my first AA meeting that I'd gone to in like 9 years. And I went to a place called Morning Miracles in Oakwood. And I don't remember much about that meeting, but I picked up my white chip. The second time that I went, I had a lady after the meeting. I was talking and I was reading the promises, and I was shaking. And I said, I'm happy to say that I'm not shaking from the DTs. I'm just shaking because of my anxiety. And when I got up to leave, she came up to me and she said, do you have a sponsor? I said, no. And she handed me her card. It said, Peace of Mind Pet Care. And I looked at it. And I was like, I've seen this card before. I've seen this card every year. It comes at Christmas time at our vet's office. It was my sponsor's pet sitting business. And I said, there's another God sign for me, that I needed to pick up the phone. And I don't know if I would, when I would have gotten a sponsor, if I would not have, you know, if she would not have handed me that card. So picked up the phone and called Lindsay. And we worked together and worked through the steps. Went through my inventory. I had been through a pretty extensive inventory. I knew that at that time I knew I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And I was beginning to believe, again, that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Things started to get better. I made amends at my work. I made amends with my parents for all the lying that I had done to them. And, you know, got onto some medication for my anxiety and depression. Things were going along really well. And I was getting close to almost 2 years when I had recently had a fallout with something had happened, and now I don't even remember what it was, but something had happened that was a really stressful situation, and there's a type of disease that happens that when you get in a stressful situation, about 3 months later, your hair starts to fall out. And I had that happen once. And then it started to happen again. And I started to have terrible, terrible anxiety for no reason at all. And it was worse than the anxiety and the shakes that I had when I didn't have alcohol. And I couldn't explain it. I was on the maximum dose that I could be of the depression medicine that I was on. And I just thought, this is just the way I'm going to be. I'm going to be like this forever. My hair started falling out again in clumps. And I was not talking to my sponsor about it. I shut down again. I closed those four walls again. And I picked up again. And picked up my two-year chip. And 2 weeks before that, I had picked up. So I picked up my two-year chip, and it was a lie. And, you know, the good alcoholic that I am, I pretended like, you know, it was fine. It took just 4 months for me to bottom out again. And I did. I bottomed out pretty hard. And it happened. I basically was in a blackout for about a week. And it was a Thursday that I was supposed to chair a meeting for the Morning Miracles. And my sponsor called me and said, sent me a message and said, you know, where are you? And I just said, I'm drunk. And a couple of days later, my parents showed up at the front door. And I don't remember what I said to them. Something to the point of, you should just leave me. I'm broken. I'm not fixable. I said, I just, you know, I'm worthless. I just want to die. And, you know, they sat with me through that. And I called Lindsay and apologized to her. And she told me, you need to go and pick up a white chip tomorrow. You need to do that tomorrow morning. So I went and I picked up a white chip. And the hardest thing for me to do is pick up a white chip in my home group. It's a huge group on Sunday mornings. And I did it. I got up and I picked up that white chip. And I started over again. And what I realized that I had not realized before is that in the 12 steps, in that first one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives would become unmanageable. I knew that. I had that step down. But when I picked up that last time, I didn't care. I knew my life was going to become unmanageable again. I knew I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't care. What I had lost was came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I lost that. And the principle behind that step is hope. And I completely lost that hope. And through hitting that bottom again, I got some hope back. I really and truly had not dove into the program as much as I thought I did. I still was a little bit on the outside. I still wasn't fully in the middle. You know, how they say, you know, if you're not in the middle, you know, you're easily going to fall off the side of the boat. And so what I did was I went to my doctor, explained what was going on with me. She put me on some different medication, which helped tremendously. But I dove back into the big book, went back another 90 meetings in 90 days. And then this time, for real, put my hand into my higher powers and just have really just let go and accepted that I am not in control of anything except my own actions. And I just really love what has happened for me over the last several months that never would have happened to me if I not had this program, been in this program. Some of the most wonderful things that have happened, and my eyes have been opened to the things that my higher power has shown me. I never would have been strong enough. I've gone through helping a friend go through cancer and seeing her at the end. And I never would have done that had I not had this program. You know, it would have been, and even if I would have been there, it would have been all about me. You know, all about how this was affecting me and not what she was going through, and making this all about, you know, my struggle, my sadness. And today I'm able to hopefully give a little bit more than I take. I'm certainly not perfect, but I try to get better each day. And before I close, my favorite thing in the big book is on page 417. It's not even in the 164 pages. It's in Acceptance Was the Answer. It's my absolute favorite. I highlight it and underline it, and somebody was talking about it. We actually did a meeting about it yesterday. And this is what I go to every time I start feeling out of control. I start feeling less than, or feeling that I cannot move forward because of something someone else is doing or some sort of roadblock in my way. I have to remember that this passage, it's, and acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. Thank you, everybody, for listening to my story. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Marnie, for being so rigorously honest. Really, that was remarkable. I know that I'm not going to take a drink tonight, and I hope the rest of you guys feel the same way. You know, that acceptance thing, and that I was in that meeting, and I was going to share, but I didn't. So I'm going to, what I was going to share was the me version of the serenity prayer. Is God grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know that one is me. So that's my 2 cents. Thank you, Marnie. It's wonderful. Okay, I didn't ask anybody to hand out the chips. Do we have a volunteer? Yes, come. Please, introduce yourself. And the chips are right here.
Hi, my name is Jeremiah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jeremiah.
How's it going? So the first one we do is the white chip for one day if you want to try this way of life. The second one is silver chip for 30 days. Third one is bronze for 60 days. Next one is red for 3 months, 90 days. Next one is yellow for 6 months. Green for 9 months. And then blue for years or multiples thereof. And then the last one is the white chip again.
Get a chance.
Thank God for the chips you hold.
Thanks,
Jeremiah. Okay. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight.
Just another homesick child ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its day and the lessons full of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.